Hi, this is Jeff from RPG Circus. We had a few technical difficulties during the remaking of this episode, and we lost a section of the Kickstarters and the bundle of holding. That said, I am going to re-record some of that tonight, and so you're going to notice a little bit of change in audio. However, most of the episode is intact, especially our interview with Mike, so sit back and enjoy the episode.
Welcome to Season 10, Episode 7 of RPG Circus, the greatest show in gaming. In this episode, we have Mike Myler, who graciously decided to take us up on our offer, and we're going to talk about adventures. Again, welcome to Season 10, Episode 7 of RPG Circus. My name, of course, is Jeff, and joining me this episode is Chris. Welcome, Chris.
Howdy, howdy.
And, of course, as I said in the intro, Mike is with us as well. Hello, Mike.
Howdy, howdy.
I'm really glad you took us up on our offer, as it was.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
What is it? I didn't actually look at the news. You posted something about news. Completely bypassed it. That happens.
Well, it's more of a random thought more than anything else. Basically, somebody took an AI to create new D&D monsters, and they basically posted the results, and I don't know. I'm getting to the vibe that, well, yeah. Let's just say it's neat and kind of terrifying if you ever build anything.
I definitely saw something on there. I was like, oh my god, I made that thing. It's like a teleporting slug swarm or something like that, and I was like, I definitely have that.
Yeah.
These robots are going to put me out of business sooner than I thought.
Yeah. Shill while you can. That's all I'm going to put it.
Well, you know, I think I've said it before, I still think, although it never created absolutely 100 fantastic, but I still remember the old Dragon magazine. And when I say old, it was like in the Best of the Dragon Vault, which obviously meant that it was a much earlier Dragon magazine. It was like random monsters. It was just a way to generate like something completely random. So. Because the tagline was, is like, do your players know the monster? Or basically all the monsters that you have? Here you go.
So fine, that sounds dope.
What was it?
That sounds dope. I'll have to find that.
Yeah, definitely if you have, like, if you know someone who has, like, the old PDFs of the old Dragon magazine, it's N1. It's weird. That's one of the weird things about that particular collection of Dragon magazines. They have all the Dragon magazines except for the Best of volume. And you're like, you printed them, wouldn't you just, I know it's an anthology of just bits and pieces of ones, but wouldn't you include that any for completeness sake?
I don't know. There's a lot of weird stuff that went down with the TSR, WotC, Hasbro, blah, blah, blah.
Exactly. All right, well, why don't we talk about the topic of question, which was, first off, we, of course, we wanted you to sell us on Imperial Matchmaker and Trade War.
All right, cool. So, these are set in Mists of Akuma, which is my Eastern Fantasy Noir steampunk campaign setting. If you think of it like Ravenloft plus Ninja Scroll plus Warhammer 40,000, sort of. It's like a mix of those in like a one sentence. Basically, the continent of Soberin has, for the past 150 out of 160 years, been occupied by foreign invaders that, with superior technology, drafted all the natives into a war across the Great Divide, which is across the edge of the world, and in very, very distant lands. And about 50, 60 years ago, they just all contact broke off. And they kept the subjugation going on for another like 50 years. And then the locals led a rebellion, reseated the emperor in his throne, and peace reigned for about a decade. Then the Mists of Akuma show up. And they're these primordial fog that strips people of their humanity until they're transformed into Odedo Oni, which are fast zombies. And in the case of items, it can cause things to age much faster than normal and change into Tsukumogami, which are a thing from Japanese folklore, because we did draw a lot of stuff from real-world folklore and myths from Eastern cultures to make this one. And it changes into a monster, which is either, if it was treated with a lot of respect while an inanimate object, good. It could be like a nice monster. Or in most cases, like specifically for war machines, it changes into like a terrifying, you know, beast that is just bent on killing people. And that's the setting. And we already did that. We kickstarted it 2 years ago. It's an awesome book. I had to colorize it all, actually, because the printer, after like a year, started messing up my black and white prints, which drove me insane, because I did like 7 proofs for those prints.
Wait a minute. You had to colorize it?
Because how
do you mess up a black and white print?
So when I say black and white, I mean the back of the page background was black, and then the text was, and they just were not handling it well. Like, the text would do okay, but all the images would get I kept getting this super ink saturation thing. So it has to do with, like, I'm going to get a little InDesigning on you. When you send an ink file or, like, any image to a printer, there are different profiles that will come in. And in the case of books, most of the time they want a CMYK profile. And that tells the printer how much ink to put on any spot to get the right color. And there's an ink threshold of about 235 for black ink. And you can check this before you send it in. You have to, because if you don't, you'll get bad prints. And in the case of Missive Akuma, I think what I ended up landing on was like a 212% instead of 235. So I did steps down, just like printing every 5 or 10 different degrees until I finally, like, okay, that's how the image is supposed to look. And then, yeah, a customer emailed me like a couple of months ago, like 2 months ago, I think, and was like, hey, my book came in funny. And I was like, ah, fine, God. So I colorized everything. Well, I've been doing the adventures in color, and none of those had printed wrong. So I was like, well, you know, I just have to give up on this. And I shouldn't be so upset about it, because a lot of the, you know, the dragon chapter and the Oni chapter are much cooler with color. But I worked so hard to get that black and white, like, noir feel, and we finally, like, nailed it. And at least the Kickstarter backers got, like, the book they're supposed to get. So, you know. Anyway, now we're doing a second Kickstarter, and this is for 3 books, actually. One is the Imperial Matchmaker Adventure Path, which is a big hardcover book that takes characters from 4th to 10th level in Sanbao Shi, because, like, most of the gaming in Missive Akuma is supposed to happen inside of cities. That's the noir part. And in the Imperial Matchmaker, the Emperor is tired of this, like, really long feud going on between 4 clans near the Imperial Prefecture. And it's all over the Battle of Broken Spears and 400 years ago, so he's done with it. And he decrees that, like, 20 brides and grooms from those clans are going to get married. And it's going to be a big celebration, and everyone's going to be happy. And that's what the PCs get tossed into. And they, you know, either participate in the sabotage of these ceremonies or stop them. I mean, it's a sandbox adventure, so what they do is entirely up to the GM and the players. That's the adventure path. And then the second part is the Imperial Matchmaker Guests, which is a softcover book that has 8 characters that are iconics for the Missive Akuma. So you could play them as Friedrich or...
Cool.
Yeah, and like Claudio Poses did the art for them. So if nothing else, go and check out Claudio's art. He's amazing. He does Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, the core Dungeons & Dragons line. He does a lot of really, really great stuff. And he nailed all the iconics. And it's super exciting to order. I get to order art from a lot of different people. And like there are people that I'm like trying to help get better and so on, you know. But Claudio is somebody where you send the art order and then whatever he sends you back is better than whatever you had in your head, which is just phenomenal.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Because it's like, I thought of this character. How could you think of the character looking cooler than I thought of the character? I came up with the character. But like, that's his job, right? You know? So.
Yeah, I suck at that. It's real. That's one of those. That's the dirty little secret for me. It's like, I just... Sometimes I'm just like, I don't know, like, doesn't matter. You know, which is probably why I don't write adventures. You know, I'll run adventures, but I don't really, you know, and I'm obviously my own games, I'll write some adventures for that, but it's like, I'm not a professional adventure writer for them.
For my own characters, it doesn't normally matter unless it's like a thing for the character. Like, I had a naked half-orc that, like, didn't believe in gender and was just like a complete hippie. And it was important how he looked, right? Because he was, you know, naked all the time. But for most of the time, yeah, it's like, oh, he's got armor and a shield, whatever.
Yep.
Not the iconics, though. The iconics are all super duper iconic. And the idea is that you can use them as pre-generated characters if you don't want to make your own characters. And they all have, like, a special thing and subplots woven into the two adventures here. Or two adventure books, I should say. And then if you don't want to make them, like, your character, then you can, the GM can use them as, like, rival party throughout either one of the adventure books. Yeah. They have builds from 3rd through 10th level. Although the free PDFs on the Kickstarter page, of which there are 9, have the builds at 4th and 7th. Yeah, I'm a big believer in... And then the last part is Trade War. So since Missive Akuma came out, I've made 6 adventures total for it. And they're all progressing in level. So you could already, if you wanted to, go buy like all 6 Missive Akuma adventures and run a campaign. But the Trade War adventure path collects them all together and then adds like a larger narrative that uses a bunch of the like design seeds and story elements that I left open-ended in the adventure books to tie them together into this big trade war between secret merchant guilds and Shinobi clan.
Nice.
That's the Kickstarter.
Say that 3 Thanks. Times fast, right?
Yeah, it's a lot.
Oh no, it looks amazing. Like I backed the original and I had a blast when I think you ran it for our gaming group one of those days. And honestly, I like the feel of the environment. I like the Eastern feel mixed with... I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that you're a bit of an otaku as well.
A little bit. I'm also a big fan of Chinese culture and have spent an enormous amount of time in Chinese restaurants because I used to work in them.
You used to work in a Chinese restaurant. Wow.
Well, I'm allergic to milk, and milk didn't really make it into the diet except for in Mongolia. And even then, it didn't really take. So, like, if I go to an Indian restaurant, the chances are very good they're going to poison me on accident. But in a Chinese restaurant, I can order pretty much anything.
Well, that's a good sign.
That's good.
If you got a friend that can't do milk, take him to a Chinese restaurant.
Well, hopefully they don't have any other allergies.
Yeah, you learn something new every day. We eat.
Is that where you get? Is that working in a Chinese restaurant? Is that where you got your initial interest in Far East? I hate to say the Far East. It sounds so 20th century or 18th century.
Yeah, Eastern cultures and stuff like that. That had started when I was a teenager, because I got way into reading and I read some stuff. I read Nietzsche, and my parents were not pleased with that one. So then I tried some Eastern things, and then I found the Tao Te Ching, which is written by a guy named Lao Tzu. It's spelled Tao Te Ching, with the T's.
I'm familiar with it. I forget the translated version that I actually liked. Fuck it. I've had a couple of copies.
It matters which translation you have, too, because a lot of texts, it's pretty... Like, if you're reading Greek texts, you gotta find some really biased people to translate it very differently. But with the Tao, I found there's a lot of variance.
I know this sounds weird, folks, but I'm actually going to try to see.
It's cool. If you have not read the Tao Te Ching or know what it is, it's essentially a long list of parables and poems. And I don't know. There's a Church of Tao, which I think is ridiculous and insane.
Yeah, he didn't quite believe in religion.
Yeah, he didn't believe in religion. So what are you doing? Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's a philosophy much more than anything else.
Yeah, this is the one because I've read a couple other translations or tried to. For me, I like this Witter Biner. It's like the first one that comes up if you look it up as on.
With a Y.
I just felt it was less. That's just
all said it. It talks about the master. The master must show up 1,000 times. So, you got to read the whole thing. It's worth the read.
It actually is very interesting. And I forget. I think I used it. I know I used it in a class that I was taking where, they wanted you to compare and contrast some book with some other book. And it's here I go. It was I don't want to say it was a philosophy class, but it was some sort of quasi-business class. I think it was what the hell was the book? You know what? I know what book it was. Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People.
That's a good contrast book. Yeah, that's where it started for me. And then I used to take martial arts when I was younger, too.
I never got there. I watched a lot of martial arts movies when I was a kid. I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough that, I grew up in the 80s, where all of a sudden, that was brand new for everybody. You figured, in terms of media, that's when all, the early Chuck Norris movies were out. The USA Network used to have Kung Fu Theater. I mean, my personal favorite, oddly, even today, for weird Chinese martial art movies, still is The Five Deadly.
Mm. I've seen that one. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I know. It's just one of those weird ones. It's like, okay.
I looked up the 36 Chambers of Shaolin, which was also excellent if you haven't seen it. The Wu-Tang Clan did an album called The 36 Chambers of Shaolin, and it's... I assume they did it while or were inspired by watching this movie, and it's this guy going through all these different weird trials. My favorite was he's got a pole with the water baskets, over his shoulders, but they've got daggers sticking out of them. So if he slides with one end, it'll stab him in the side, and it's just hundreds of people like that running up ramps and stuff. It's
yikes.
Yeah, you couldn't do that here.
Problem.
They'd be CGI that. Jeez. Yeah, no, I did a couple ATA classes, and I was like, oh, this is terrible. But there's a great, I live in Pittsburgh, there's a great studio run by Master Rothrock. It's a Northern Eagle Claw, which is a Northern Shaolin Fist style. Focuses on the legs. I only got to do it for about a year, and I've been meaning to go back.
Oh, no worries. Yeah. Because it's I'm always interested to know why, because let's face it, I know... For most people, it's foreign, but it's weird because it's especially in the 80s, anytime anything Eastern was really kind of, which is why, you know, start seeing in the 80s the early RPG related martial arts stuff that's not quite right in any way, shape, or form, and it's probably very I don't know what's the right word,
the mythologization of other cultures. But are you familiar with Record of Lodoss War?
That one I am not.
Yes, I am.
Okay, used to be on the Sci-Fi Channel back in the 90s. That's when I first saw it. So it's this anime about what you would think is like a standard medieval fantasy D&D party, but it like started as a D&D game that somebody began in Japan after they brought the books with them, and then it got serialized into like a computer magazine, and then made into a manga, and then made into an anime. So it's like it's a Japanese D&D game anime. it's awesome.
Instead of the other way around, right?
Yeah. It's the other way around, right? Exactly. Yeah.
No, that's fascinating.
The first season is way better than the second season, but Record of Lodoss War.
Never heard of that one.
Yeah, it's fun, but I also saw the sequel series, which is very serious for the first half and then becomes something like really chibi for the second half.
That's so much flashbacks. It's just like Flashback City.
Yeah, well, again, they told their tale, and now they're trying to basically fix it up enough to get another series.
Yeah, and they had like a Dreamcast game at some point, too, and
wow.
MMO now, I think.
You know, but that's definitely a cultural, because it's like some of that stuff, I don't know, I always find that anything, at least in the U.S., any that's sort of gaming, I'll be blunt, say like the Dungeons and Dragons, it's just horrible in any way, shape, or form. You know, so anytime anyone says, we need to make this a movie, I'm like, you guys have freaking idea how bad it might be. You know, where it seems like, at least in Japan, they have a history. They don't even tell the same story. They may have the same characters, but it's not quite the same.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a different form of story structure and all that. But moreover, I don't think they began with the D&D stuff. Like, they had the manga script, and that's probably where they began. It's way easier if you've already got, like, everything storyboarded, right?
Mm-hmm. I guess besides the game that you created and stuff, obviously we talked about your Eastern passions, for lack of a better term. What other gaming, floats your boat, for lack of a better term?
Oh, sure. Last month, my fifth campaign setting came out. It's called Book of Exalted Darkness.
Okay.
So, Miss Fukuma is complicated. Just, all right, let me see if I can elevator pitch this one.
okay, hey, chill while you care.
So, the idea was I wanted to make a book. I wanted to make the 5e Book of Vile Darkness, but you can't really do that because the Book of Vile Darkness is not OGL, right? Yeah. It's not on the Open Gaming License. Mm-hmm. So, it's more like an ode to the Book of Vile Darkness, but my other problem with that is whenever you run a game for evil people, inevitably, like, they are evil to one another, and the group will dissolve, right? Yep. So I set out to make a world where like, the world itself would kind of prevent that, and I came up with this place called Askis, A-S-K-I-S. I want to remind everyone at this point that this has already been funded on Kickstarter, and a lot of really wonderful people pledged a lot of money for me to make this world, and I take it very seriously. But it's called Askis because it's created for you to destroy, right? It's this decopunk utopia, so think like 1920s-era technology, and everything is powered by this stuff called a Nagua, this clean, limitless energy source, and if that wasn't like dope enough, it extends the lifespan of creatures that are good of heart. So what's happened is that evil is just kind of dying out. And just before, like, you know, good has finally won the day and balance is forever, you know, thrown away to the wind. And all of this is predicated by nine people called the Celestial Heroes that are the demigods of the world.
Yeah.
So, like, right before their victory is complete, these mad scientists do this thing that causes a whole bunch of people, like one in every 100,000, I think it is, to have an inherent heresy. So they're just inherently evil. And then they carefully predicate them and select them, so then like when it's their time to activate, they find them, give them a duty, and like bring them into the war against good. And that's the Book of Exalted Darkness.
You know, because you did, because that was always, that's always been my question. Any game, it's like, how do you really run? You know, I've always heard people, oh, it's an all evil. Hey, doesn't that just degenerate at a certain point?
Yeah, it's like, so what drug is the rogue giving all of you guys when you show up to game that you think that this is an all evil game that everyone's like, oh yeah.
You know, it's kind of like my favorite always is that, you know, if you actually truly try to follow the old D&D alignments, everyone's chaotic evil. Really?
Yeah.
You know,
Well, the trick is either you're cartoony and you're chewing the cardboard and so forth, or you're a planner, which means as soon as you succeed, the game ends. Or if you fail, the game ends. So basically, unless you're in agreement with the rest of your party members, with the cartoony evil, you're going to end up at a point where you either are part of the plot or you're ruining the plot.
So one of the things that I think a lot of people make the mistake of, and we never did this when I did an evil game in high school, was you should have like during session zero, there should be a pretty substantial discussion of consent, right?
Yes.
So in the discussion of consent, you should lay out in general, broad strokes, what kind of terrible evil shit's going to go down. So if people are going to be raped, if people are going to be hearing long descriptions about somebody having their body ripped in half, talk about that potential. And maybe you don't know, maybe a player has seen a construction incident where that happened and they don't particularly want to relive that. Then, okay, don't talk about that. Don't do that. Do something else for this part of the evil campaign. And then it also lets you say, okay, this is how evil we're going to be. Are we doing twirling mustache lady on the railroad tracks evil, or are we wearing cloaks made out of baby flesh? Yeah. And setting that barometer helps too, because if somebody shows up to twirl their mustache and there's another guy over there bathing in the blood of virgins, there's gonna be some problems just from the assumptions people have for the game.
Yeah, lines and veils. Basically, draw the lines, draw the veils. It's pretty much independent of any game, but in an evil game, it becomes better than most.
Yeah,
maybe even set a mandate. Nobody's allowed to betray anybody for the first five parts. But at the sixth part, you got the setup here.
I think I spent six pages talking about ways to try to get the party to not kill one another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very important. And again, one of the ways I found out in the past is everybody plays a henchman with their goal. I actually ran a while back a Master of the Universe campaign of all things. And everybody was playing essentially a henchman that was basically hired as temporary because everybody else was out of town. But you were still dedicated to the cause of trying to, stop Eternia. So everybody had the same walking papers. They may have a different way of doing it, but they're all loyal enough. And also they're terrified of when Skeletor shows up.
Yeah. I kind of use the mad scientist as a way to do that. So in the end of the book, there are two adventures. And one of them is to set the tone of the campaign that you're supposed to play with the book, which is very, very, very evil. So you kidnap two kids from high school and then kill them and blaspheme their bodies and then escape. And you're aided by Gaspadrio, the flesh doctor. And then Gaspadrio sends you out on missions and gives you gifts and shit. And becomes your, you kind of become his henchman. I hadn't actually thought about it in those terms, but that is pretty much exactly what the book suggests.
Okay, well, yeah. That's cool. That's kind of neat. I kind of going back to Mists of Akuma, I like your tag phrase of survival in a dying world. And just how it actually basically sums up everything in a nutshell. Eastern aspects aside, or, Eastern fantasy things aside, ultimately it's a survival game in a dark world.
Yeah. Zombie hordes attack fairly frequently, and it's kind of fun to watch what people do after the first or second time they arrive in a town and waves of sprinting zombies show up, because they develop different strategies. Okay, throw the wind wall over there, and quick, you're the fast one, hit him with an expeditious retreat so you can go warn all the townspeople, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Survival is very important, and it's kind of the only victory you get in Mists of Akuma, because they're all supposed to be Pyrrhic victories. So even when you win, you don't really win. It's not like you won the game. It's more like you won the game and your star player broke his leg.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense here. That'd be interesting to see what is your ultimate endpoint, because I believe you use a 5e base for the engine. Is that correct?
Yeah, although there is a version for Shadow of the Demon Lord that went into print last month.
Okay. I got a strange question to ask you. How would you define a 20th level campaign in your world?
Ooh.
It
would involve the Yai Sovereigns, which are the most powerful Oni in the book,
okay.
I would think. Yeah. And then I would imagine the Emperor at that point, too, and all the power that the Silberin can bring to bear. And then at least two of the generals, because there are still two generals that have high-tech stuff. One of them has a hovercraft, so probably that one.
Oh, nice. And,
yeah. She plays a part in Imperial Matchmaker. There's definitely stuff in there, although the focus is on the mid game for sure. Whenever I make a campaign saying that's, I'm kind of thinking most about the depending on what system you're talking about. Typically, it's, if you're talking about 20th level systems, between 5th and 12th level where the game is really good. And then after that, like, you'll find people who really are into epic level stuff, and that's cool. And you'll find people who want to play at first level for, like, months and months at a time, and that's fine. But in general, that's where the design sweet spot tends to be.
Yeah, it's funny. That, to me, that goes back even way... And any level system I've ever played, there's always been a sweet spot. Like, you know, as many of our listeners will know, that I played a bunch of old first edition AE, and definitely back then the sweet spot was like between, you know, fourth and ninth. It always, somewhere around there.
Is that, are you talking like Fighting Man first edition?
I'm talking about Advanced Dungeons and Dragons.
Okay.
Before it even had an edition.
All right. So you are talking Fighting Man. So when did you get access to like Fly and Fireball? Because that's typically where I set the marker.
About fifth is still, you know, because Fly and Fireball even back then were little spells. So
yeah, that's when the game really opens up, because that's when your character's mobility becomes much, much larger, and you can do terrible things just being able to fly and having, you know, a strength score of a regular human.
But I mean that's the funny thing. I mean, even in more modern editions, really, I agree with you. I think the mid levels are usually the more interesting bits, you know. I think some of the design changes that have happened, especially, you know, like for what, you know, if you look at a first level character for fifth edition, and obviously if you look for a first level character for the original Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, they're not even comparable.
Yeah.
You know. It's like, you know, in terms of options. But it's interesting that even now, I mean, even back then and today, it really is, you know, kind of the fifth through, I don't know. You say 12th, I say, you know, ninth or whatever. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's pretty close. And I think for myself, you know, like, for example, I've looked at, like, the, like, Paizo has done all their adventure paths. And, you know, their adventure paths, you know, it's usually six books, and it takes, their rule is it takes you from first level to like 14th or 15th level. And I'm like, you know, you read the latter half of the book, and even then you're just like, wow, you know, at the end of this adventure, yeah, maybe, but really? You know, I don't know. I was running the second Darkness set, adventure path, and I think the group that I was running in, I don't think we got past like the third or fourth book.
They've been doing a good job about broadening the sweet spot, like with each edition, right? Like I think third did a good job, but it sort of 11th level, 10th level is kind of where I'd want to stop at third, because the number of books they released, you had to curate everything that people would be playing with, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm just gonna skip talking about fourth, and then fifth, it's more fun to play at lower levels for sure than playing a first level character in like third edition. But like once you get past like 12th level, you get these spells, and it's kind of the same in third edition, where the spells make it, you have so many ways to come at a problem. If you have a high level spellcaster, especially one that like has spells that they can prepare instead of just, you know, like they only know, you know, 17 spells. That's it. That's the only ones the GM really has to worry about. But then there's this wizard who's got the spell book. Oh, I got Scry. I got Mama's Scry. I got Daddy's Scry. I got all these Scry spells. So like the stuff you have to worry about when you're trying to control the story as the GM, like trying to protect your main antagonists and stuff like that, the ways that a 19th level wizard can come at that are so many and so varied that you have to rely on GM fiat, which sucks, and I hate that.
Would you say you almost need to have the equivalent of done in episode 0 to episode 20?
Yeah.
Where you kind of sit down and say, okay, how do you want to approach this problem, just so I can set up the proper encounters and make sure it's challenging without breaking the game.
Yeah, that's planning sessions definitely happen in game, and they become much more common the higher level you get, and they take up much more time.
Well, and that's what I always thought funny is that, you know, you had AD&D back then, and eventually you had just like the other offshoots called Dungeons and Dragons, although, you know, that was the original base, you know, basic expert. Forget what the hell the other cat companion immortal rules.
Yeah, sounds about right.
And I always thought it was funny. It's like, you know, you get to the immortal rules and you're just like, really? Who plays that?
Yeah.
You know? I don't know how that, you know, and supposedly from what I understand, some people claim it worked great. I'm just like, at that point, really, do I want to really go there? You know,
Did you see Mythic Adventures from Paizo?
No, I did not.
Okay, so they decided for epic level stuff, they weren't just going to make, like, here's the 21st to 48th level fighter or whatever. It's a rules template that you put over the regular Pathfinder rules, so you could have a demigod character at first level. Yeah, conceptually, it's brilliant. I have some issues with the way they implemented it, but the concept for just like having a, you know, here's the immortal rules template essentially was so good.
Yeah, I think this is, like I said, for me, this is how levels is kind of. I've kind of definitely, if anyone who's obviously listened to the show knows, it's like I do a lot of Savage Worlds because while there are sort of, there's still experience and there's kind of, and you do have some problems, get a lot of edges, heights. Even then, I'd rather deal with that than the problems that I think 17 level characters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just one of those things, you know, and it's funny because even hit points, if you do nothing else, hit points alone really changes the equation, you know, at a certain level. I mean, and it's kind of been a weird known thing because I remember reading what that was. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with the old Arduin system, or I don't even hate to even call it a system. They were quasi supplements for D&D / their own
Arduin.
Yeah, Dave Hargrave. Yeah.
I'm not familiar, but I'll find out.
Right. So in one of these mini books that people used as kind of supplemental / additional material for D&D back in the day, there was one of his proposed, you know, because there was like, there's just like stuff in there, proposed ideas. You didn't have to use it or not. But one of them was just almost normalizing hit points to the point where a first level fighter and the 10th level fighter, the hit point differences between them would be like something ridiculous, like maybe only like 10 or 15, you know? Because it's like, well, you know, if you have a first level fighter and this really high level fighter, typically they can't fight back to back because one of them would just die like that. You know, there's no chance. And it's true. And it's like, of course, with a change that they were proposing in that, there had to be changes like the healings. But he's like, well, you know, cure light wound, you know. And so, but I knew a lot of people that would actually use those rules with a combination of, I think, like race and class together gave you your starting hit point. And then your increase in level was just like, you'd get like maybe 2 or 3 hit points every time you'd
depend. Oh, you know what? I really like the Star Wars D20 hit point system where it was still D20 level, and there's a problem anytime you have something that large, because essentially the prop stat, in order for everything to work out together in probability and statistics and to feel like there's, you know, drama in the mechanics of the game, there has to be a high level of variance for the 20th. But you just lost your, no. I lost my thought. God damn it.
Well, we were talking about hit points.
yeah. And then, what was I going to say?
You're talking about mortality and health.
Oh, the Star Wars D20. Yeah, yeah. Mortality. Right. Yeah, right. I'm so sorry. So critical hits went straight to your constitution score. So if you could be a 20th level character, and a lot of people complained about this, but I thought it was awesome, and get hit with like a critical hit from like, you know, one of those stormtrooper mounted tripod blaster things, and they could kill you. Because it would go straight to your constitution score, and the increases you could get to constitution score were just like any other ability score, which is to say not a ton.
Yeah.
That's actually I never did the 20 Star Wars. I still have the old
Star Wars Saga.
Yeah, the old Westing games, which I don't know. I that's one of those games I will never play again, but I'm not getting rid of it. You know, I actually even have the old Star Warrior game, which is it's the fighter ship combat game that you can play, and it was really complex. I mean, it had like, you had like almost like a character sheet for the sheet ship, and you had tokens that you would sit on, like, I'm going to do a roll and a jink, and you would allot things, and there were difficulty numbers for each of those maneuvers based on that ship, and you added them all up, and then when you did the maneuver, you rolled your piloting dice, and you had to beat that number. It was fascinating, you know, in terms of that. Never played it. Read it. You know, I still own it. And I actually have doubled the counters. And the reason I have doubled the counters is when I was a child, because I owned it when I was, I don't know, 13, something like that. I lied to them. It's a funny thing. I sent them a letter saying, hey, you know, I'm missing my sheet. What will it cost me to get a replacement? Instead of actually sending me quoting me a price, they just sent me a new sheet.
Oh, that's nice.
So that was nice of them. I lied to them, but I got double the counters. So,
oh, my.
You know, but it was not like I was saying, give me a new sheet. I was like, hey, offering to pay for it, but I lied the fact that I didn't have one.
Oh, I got a book I don't think I'll ever get to use it, but it's the Authority RPG, and I got it at Half Price Books because it was real cheap, and I like The Authority, which is a comic book by Warren Ellis, I think. No, Alan Moore? One of those two guys. And it's like if the Justice League decided that instead of like saving the world, they were going to start fixing it. And it's, it uses the Tri-Stat system, which I think is a little clumsy, but at the end it's got a random character generator, And I remember you must have used that thing for hours, just like rolling random crazy superheroes and supervillains, because it was, for all of its failings, it was amazing for random stat generation.
And by the way, it is Ellis.
It is Ellis? Well, yeah, okay. And it's a good comic book, too, if you've never read it. I really enjoy the Authority books.
Yeah, I've never played the Tri-State, so can't comment on that. But, you know, I love the concept of superheroes in an RPG. I've just never found one. You know, I used to, as people will know, I've played a lot of Champion way back, obviously, in the early 80s. And today, I just would never do it.
Was the Champions book still the size of the Britannica Encyclopedia
in
the 80s?
No. I mean, I'm talking Champion 2nd Edition, which was, I don't know, maybe 100 pages, if that.
Okay, that's not too bad.
No, I mean, it's like, and they had, I mean, this was back when, if you wanted martial arts, you just said, my skill is martial arts. And the point cost for martial arts was equal to your main stat.
Wow, that's nice and simple.
And they did that because they wanted to, you didn't want to have super strong characters with martial arts. That was, and it's like, and so what would happen is, increase the damage that you did with martial arts, you would take martial arts again. So the low strength guys could actually do major damage by just having all these skill points in martial arts. Character points, whatever. So very simple system, very simple characters, you know. And I think that's, you know, you definitely had to not nitpick your powers. You know, like some people are like, you know, I would be Batman with all these. It's like way back in the early internet days, I probably still find them somewhere. Someone's archived them. But, you know, people would do like build in Champions for like Superman, be something ridiculous, like 4,000, 5,000 character points. And you're like, yeah, they accounted for every single power that they've ever seen and every single comic book imaginable / media.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever go to superdickery.com? You should. You will be amazed at the powers that Superman has.
Is that the one that takes all the comic book covers of the Superman Golden Age comics and Silver Age and has really weird situations that are on the cover that has absolutely nothing to do with the actual comic itself?
And excerpts of him doing stuff like Super Weaving, and I can't remember all the other ones.
Super Weaving.
Yeah, I think I remember the time when he basically tried to marry Jimmy Olsen to a gorilla on the cover.
He does some terrible, horrible things to Jimmy and Lois. Horrible, horrible things all the time.
Yeah. Okay, one more question, I guess. What media would you recommend before playing your role-playing game, Miss Vakuma?
Ooh, Afro Samurai. That'd be very high on my list for that. Ninja Scroll. Somebody told me the other day that I need to see Kibinari, The Iron Fortress, which is, I guess, a recent anime. It came out in 2016.
I've heard that one.
What is it about? Is it about zombies attacking fortresses? Because in that case, it's probably very good.
You know, I don't know. I just know that I've heard of the title and I've heard people recommend I should see it. And I'm just like, okay, you know, it's not on my to-do list right now.
Yeah, it's like I have books I need to write. But I mean, like, I'm going to watch it eventually. I will. I would suggest those. Sin City would probably be good, too, to get you in the right mood.
Mm-hmm.
And then for reading, I would recommend Warhammer 40,000, just because I love the Black Library an awful lot.
That sounds great, actually. Yeah. Yeah, basically, this is such a zeitgeist, it's not even funny, this game, because I'm just reading the synopsis from my anime list. The world is in a mist of industrial revolution when horrific creatures emerge from a mysterious virus ripping through the flesh of humans to sate their ever-ending appetite. How does that not sound like your game?
Yeah, that does sound fairly... I mean, I don't have a there are viruses, but they're not doing that. Yeah. But, yeah, no, that sounds like the right feel for sure. Yeah, I look forward to watching that. That'll be good.
All right, I think we're going to go ahead and kick it into the Kickstarters and... Mike has been gracious enough to give us his opinion on some of these things as we talk about.
Yeah, because it'd be fun to hear from an expert who's ran multiple Kickstarters.
It's true. I'm 6 for 6 so far.
So first up is one that I bring up because I know a lot. I've met a lot of people that love having sort of characters. And so we have Hero of the Adventures Journal. And it's weird because, you know, it's one of those things. It's like I appreciate all the hard work that the person has done for layout and all that other stuff. But this is such a highly specialized item. And obviously the goal, which translates, you know, I guess, is they're wanting the equivalent of about over 12,000 US, and they've seriously not got that. You know, and it's a character journal. And it's like, I guess the way it's described, there's three of them. Now there is a PDF version, which personally, that's the way to do it at all. I mean, but I know a lot of people like the hard bound. You know, so maybe as a PDF, sure I can see this, but as an actual printed, you buy it. Not so much. And I mean, I'm not saying that it's not going to be great. It's just, how do I put this? It's like, it's one of those things where something like this would be great for like a character that you had a long career with, but you never know that when you're presenting.
Yeah, it's true. You kind of need to be in a game where you know for a fact, like, you're not going to have to ditch your character. Yeah. But, I mean, so he's in a tough spot because you make most of your Kickstarter money in the first week and the last week, and it's normally the first couple of days and the last couple of days. I will say that, like, the production definitely looks really nice.
No, I mean, that's the thing. You're definitely right
about that.
I give him hats off to that. It's just, I think he misjudged the market for this product, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I wonder what he settled on for. He must be planning on printing 1,000, like, offset, because that's where most of his money's going to be at, right? Because this is all grayscale art or, line drawings. And it's nice art, too.
No, it does look pretty good, so.
Yeah, he's got a good feel, but he's definitely must have set on doing a pretty big offset print run, and they normally start around 10,000.
And I guess that's why, to me, like I said, it's like, okay, the PDF versions make perfect sense.
Oh, here's where he made his mistake. It's 210 pages. That's you don't need it to be 210 pages, buddy.
Yeah, well, he did that because it gives space for three characters. 10 pages, that's 70 pages per character.
Yeah, I mean, that's a decent amount of space, and I'm wondering.
He probably should have just did 70 page booklet. But it's hard. It's like, I think you should have just said that screw the print job. Do if you want a hardcover or something, a soft cover, some sort of print on demand service, PDFs otherwise.
Yeah, if he had done this the way I do mine, he would have been funded already at this point.
Yeah.
So but I am thinking correctly, probably a print on demand would have been much better.
No, I definitely agree on that, yeah. Okay. Hopefully he comes back and does it as print-on-demand. But, I mean, you sacrifice in quality when you do print-on-demand.
No, I get that. I don't know. Just that's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's in Italy, you can tell. And, yeah, it's just a lot of money just to...
Less than this, you can get an Adventurer's Companion for Mr. Vakuma.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, and that's the thing. With any of these Kickstarters, that's one of the things that I always... I'm like... You know, the cost-benefit analysis. If I spend this money on this product, what am I losing out on? Some other product that, you know, because it's like none of us have infinite amounts of money. So, well, okay. I you know, 27 days, but you're right. If he's only at 1/12 of this, I think it's unlikely. But I agree with you. I do hope that he comes back with some sort of small scale-down projects.
And it's worth noting, he shouldn't throw, if he ends up listening to this, don't throw out your, you know, yet. You know, try to retool and do what you can now, and you know, show backers that are fun, you know, with you now, like, hey, you should stay with me if I have to do this again. And really, you shouldn't quit out on a Kickstarter until you're halfway through your funding period. If you haven't hit 33%, the likelihood of you funding is astronomical. So, like, that's when you should throw out, when you're halfway through, and if you haven't gotten a third of your fund. But okay. It's not looking good for him. Yeah,
fair enough.
All right. So next up, we have the Archive of Magic Items, which, hey, you know what? This one's actually 26 days to go.
He's going to make it.
Yeah, you think so? He's only at about 3,500 and a little over 1,000 now.
I feel very good for this guy. He's definitely in a good spot.
And, you know, let's face it. It's for 5th edition, and it's 350 magic items. And magic items are one of those weird ones in any game. You never have enough. You know, because it's like you always want to give, you know, you, as a game master, I know you always give, you get tired of having the same old magic item. So it's always nice fresh to the players. You know?
Yeah. In addition to all my other stuff, I'm the editor of E-Insider, which is a Patreon. And great if you like 5th edition stuff. And my first things that I commissioned for all this, you know, all my articles, I commissioned 5 articles for like innocuous magic items. Because I was like, I would love to be able to give something to my players that is only like 50 gold or something and magical and cool.
You know, one of my favorite articles of all time in the old Dragon magazine was a list of 100 non-violent.
Yeah, just like a comb that, you know, does your own hair for you. And like, that's it. It's just a cool comb that does that. That's it. What does it need to do? Why do you have to stab somebody with it? You know?
Yeah. A couple of my favorites was 2 anvils. One that you throw in, you know, if one's in a fire, the other one gets as hot as the other anvil does.
Oh, okay.
A ring that whoever wears it will have proper manners no matter what. And just weird things like, oh, here's a chair that is super comfortable, but no matter what happens, you can never fall asleep in it.
Yeah. But I always think that that reminds me of the old Tick cartoon when he fought the Ottoman Empress, and they basically had the world's most comfortable chair as an enemy. Basically got knocked into the chair and couldn't get out. Because
I remember that.
Which actually reminds me, either one of you guys watched the Amazon series?
I have. It's good. I like it. It's a more serious take than the Water Burton version from the 90s. Or 2000s.
Water Burton was perfect for the Tick, per se, but it turned into Seinfeld after the first episode.
Yeah.
And again, the original cartoon of the back of the 90s is still one of my favorite of all time when it comes to superhero genre.
You know, Ben Edlund also had stuff to do with the Venture Brothers, right?
That makes sense.
That explains a lot, and that means well done again.
Yeah.
I definitely have to say, I would have to say if I would ever run another superhero game, you'd have to run it as kind of at kind of the silliness that was either that was the Tick and the Venture Brothers, you know? Because I just can't take superhero stuff seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Not as a game, to play it as a game. Does that make any sense?
But the ongoing joke in my own game group is basically we want to play a stupid power game because there was this old article which was called Stupid Powers. I think it was published back in the 90s or something. And it comes up with some of the most silliest special abilities forever. And it has like a really simple mechanic to actually play it there. Don't know if we'll ever play it, but it's one of those ones that it's fun to look at.
A lot of superhero games are that way. I look at Phase Rip that way. Like, a lot of people talk about Marvel Phase Rip like, oh my god, this was the pinnacle of superhero gaming, and I look at that table and I'm just like, I don't think so. Like, it's a cool table. I'm glad that you guys enjoyed it. For the love of God, you know, play it if you want. But like, I don't know.
It's funny because that table creeped into a version of Gamma World that came out after that. They had an edition of Gamma World that had kind of that weird action-like table that was, it was heavily influenced. All right, anyway, but getting back to this archive of magic items, $15 for PDF, which is about right, I mean, for a PDF these days.
How many pages is it supposed to be, does it say?
Well,
over 350 new items. Holy crap, that's an awful lot.
So, he says about 200 pages.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Always been kind of a sucker for one of his items, for sure, that he's advertising with, the Golem suit, or basically fantasy power armor.
Yeah, looks cool. Is that Jacob Blackman art, or is that, no, that's somebody else.
I don't know who that person. It looks good, though.
Yep.
Well, that's always the other thing, you know, it's like, you know, it's for some of the smaller Kickstarters, like, I get, you know, like, the cheaper art, and I'll be honest with you, since I'm an old school, I am a big fan of the... All right, so next up, we have Uprising, Topian Universe RPG, which obviously is from Evil Hat. I don't know why, but personally, I've never been a big fan of the Fate system.
I think it really depends on having a good GM. If it's the wrong GM for the game, then, you know, you're going to have a bad time.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's just, I think, I'm gonna say this with all seriousness. Sometimes I think I'm a little too old for some of the newer gaming styles. And I don't mean that to be cruel. It's just, you know, when I played RPGs back when, it really was basically two monkeys with knives fighting. You know, I'm just saying. So sometimes it's like, yeah, I just can't get over the way this is described. I can't buy into it. I feel like an old curmudgeon. I feel like I'm too set in my ways. But on the plus side, you know, if this is, you know, I'm always a big fan of, you know, dystopian futures and cyberpunk. So if it's your thing and you happen to be a Fate person, this is your game. And he's already obviously reached his goal, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Evil Hat.
Yeah. I mean, I think.
Oh, Hicks always does. Well, is it Fred Hicks or is it somebody else? Or
Fred Hicks.
Yeah. Okay.
And he was a really nice guy, by the way.
And I mean, you know, if you back it, and as you back it, I guess you get access to the PDF. And if that's all you were looking for, you get the final one when he finally finishes it, you know, one of the revisions. So, yeah, I don't know. It's weird. I understand why most companies are starting to go this way, to say, well, if I didn't Kickstarter, then I don't have to actually pursue, you know, in a way. You know, I know a lot of companies have been kind of shifting more to Kickstarter and resales.
Yeah.
You know, and I get it, but I also think that it's like, I can understand doing a Kickstarter for something that you're really excited about, but you don't know if there will be enough.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna talk about this very briefly from the publisher side of things, right?
Okay, go for it.
You can have your own store, right? In which case, you're going to lose a small cost of upkeep and then, you know, transactions for Visa or whatever. And I would also preface this. I don't sell any stuff. All my books are licensed by companies that sell my books.
Okay.
I don't personally selling. So the publisher on DriveThruRPG, they lose about a third of the sale to DriveThruRPG. On DM's Guild, it's half of the sale that they lose to onebookshelf.com, which is the owner of DriveThruRPG, RPG Now, DM's Guild, wargamingvault.com, a couple of other websites. On Paizo, it's 25%, and there are a couple of those smaller sites, but it's 25%. If you sell through Kickstarter, you lose about 12 or 13% to Amazon, Kickstarter, and Visa. So the there's more money for you, period, you know?
Yeah, I guess when you look at the financials like that, that makes sense. That's an interesting thing.
Yeah, and just and any Kickstarter total that you see, what the person actually has to work with is about 15% of whatever the end Kickstarter total is, because you lose roughly 3% of your pledges to people who, you know, just their bank account bounced or they had a bad account or whatever.
Yeah, human error.
But still, that's so much better than 35% taken from, you know, DriveThruRPG.
Oh, agree completely. And again, this environment intrigues me, and I have played a couple of fake games in the past, but I'm going to stand by what I've said in the past. Meet with your party first before you play a fake game to make sure, like, I would argue that in a lot of ways Session Zero is more important in a fake game, because otherwise you end up in battles of personalities, because that's the whole mechanic of the game.
I completely agree with that, because my experience with Fudge Dice was exactly that, and why I don't play with a group anymore.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the other comment is that I'll make about Fate is, definitely, you're right. Session Zero is important. I played that one. Well, I didn't play. We started Diaspora. Is it Diaspora? Is that right?
Mm. Is that the crazy cyberpunk Russian?
No, it's the. It's just a science fiction.
Oh, that's Cybergen.
It's like a futuristic science fiction game.
Yeah. I think.
And the whole purpose, you know, it's like Session Zero is each player is like randomly generating two worlds for the system, and your character is from one of those two worlds up happening.
That's cool.
You know, so I mean, it's kind of cool because it's like, oh, I get to help build the universe on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's...
There are people who are showing up that aren't ready to do that.
Right. I mean, my question always was, well, what happens if a character somehow passes or something? I didn't see anything in the game, at least the books that I had, that had any notes of what happens when you have to add players later. You're not generating new worlds for them, are you?
No.
I don't know. One of those...
It could be like out of phase worlds, like in that one Star Trek. Star Trek episode.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying, it's like if you don't have high player turnout, a problem. But
yeah. No, it's really interesting. I hadn't thought about. Now I want to try something like that. That's cool. Yeah.
Well, again, Fred Hicks does good games. It's as simple as that. Okay. And it'd be fun to try something like this if you're it's your declaration.
Okay, so next up we have this is an odd one because
he is not allowed to say D&D 2E.
Yeah.
Faster from this.
Can kind of get away with it if you're doing it in like a promotional article or something, and you're writing on somebody's blog essentially. But you can't put it in your in the title of a Kickstarter like that for sure.
Yeah, I mean that was kind of weird. First off, I didn't realize the second edition was still that popular.
Yeah. OSR Revival, man.
Yeah.
Well, again, second edition I didn't think was that popular. You know, as popular. You know, I guess. But I know a lot of people that. Now that I think of it, I guess I knew a lot of people that really preferred it over first, you know, so I don't know. You know, the problem with second edition was just all this damn splat book. That's what
this
I think.
This looks like a real, like a homebrew kind of project.
No, it definitely is. Definitely the artwork definitely shows that.
280 page book. Whoa. Yeah,
I know.
That's this is his first book. Wow. Okay, buddy. Good luck.
Well, he got it. He was only asking $800.
Yeah.
And he got 13 backers to give him almost a grand.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
No, people really want to play some 2ED.
So, I mean, that's impressive. But I always, I figure what the.
Oh, he's making like a 2E book, so that's why he can afford to do it for $900. All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
The only thing how do I put this?
The World of Center looks awesome. I am a fan of that. That is cool. I'm pretty sure that he really doesn't want WotC to see this, but that is really cool.
I think I know which one you're talking about, and I agree completely.
Yeah.
I like the hybrid monster, and I will leave it at that.
Yeah. Get in here. Oh, cool. More power to him.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't think WotC's going to bother fighting him over some second edition thing. He should be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Maybe TSR would have.
No, don't even get me started on that one. That could be a story. That might be a future episode, just talking about the legal litigations of gaming.
All right. So, yes. Yes. Torg Eternity, the Living Land. I did not know people even played Torg anymore.
They did a they didn't do a Kickstarter for the last one, I think. It was they're really nice people. Game on Tabletop, I think is the name of the website. It's a European based crowdfunding website. But they did a campaign, I think, 2 years ago for Torg.
So and they've reached their goal. They were only asking 20,000 US. They got 120,000 on it.
And this is Ross Watson is the head designer on this. He's the guy working on the Warhammer 40K RPG coming out from Ulysses Spiel, Wrath and Glory. I think it hits in August. I'm pretty stoked for that.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I just never realized, like I said, that Torg was this popular.
Yeah. No, it's a surprise.
Yeah. Well, basically, I remember. Well, I backed something. I thought it was. Yeah, it was Torg Eternity. They actually put out the Kickstarter back in 2017.
Okay.
Like, so they did showed up like a month ago. So it looks awesome, but I haven't tried it yet, so I can't tell you one way or the other. But
no,
it looks, you know, again, it's trying new games and learning the new nuances of the systems. You know, depending on what you're playing here. Like, if you try a little bit of everybody else's games, you'll at least know what you like.
So they were running. They were running two. They were running a game on Tabletop and Kick. Oh, good for them. They're just taking them with both hands there.
Yeah.
Well, hey, man. Make your marketing. It's how you make your money.
Yeah, yeah. We should start a game on Tabletop campaign tomorrow.
Well, now you know. Knowing is half the battle.
So, okay. Yeah, so what do we have? Oh, yes.
Explore it.
Yeah, I like that little bit. The Forest of Adrimmon?
Adrimmon.
That's good.
That works for me.
That,
yeah, they're rocking with Magi in the next sentence, so it's definitely Adrimmon.
Okay.
It's a board game.
Is it a board game?
Yeah, it looks like a board game.
It's not only a board game, but they made money hand over fist on this one.
I saw Hex Explore it, and I'm just like, hey, that's their old school. So it's a board game, but that's cool. I like board games.
It might be a miniatures game. I don't have one to read here.
I think, it's one of those things where I always tell people, I think it is a board game. That's too bad.
Yeah.
But that's okay. Because you know what? You always need board games for when vital people for your campaign have gone missing for a session. And it's like, you don't want to cancel gaming. You just want to play something. You want to get together and be with people.
Yeah, and people like board games. You're allowed to like board games. I'm just angry at all the money board games get on Kickstarter that I don't get for making RPGs.
Yeah, unfortunately, let's be honest, board games have a larger market than...
It's true.
Yeah, but they also are kind of harder to market when you think about it, because an RPG, you can get to the point where you're like 80% done, you just need to add art, you need to add stuff here. Whereas when you're doing it with a board game, let the products beware. Heck, a couple of weeks ago we had our Palladium experience when it comes to miniature games.
Oh, the Robotech thing, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that's a shame. Actually, they, of course, as of now, you cannot get any of the Robotech. I guess the beginning of this yesterday, I guess today or today was the first day that you no longer basically destroy everything.
Yeah. Well, what's done is done. And, basically, it's a board game. And if you like it, they've funded their product.
Yeah. I don't know. Like I just saw. Sometimes I don't actually get to read some of these as fast. So next up, we do have the Red Hand of Doom 5th Edition Conversion Guide and Map, which the guy was asking $10 for, which is really,
really kind of creeps me out, to be honest with you.
Well, it kind of creeps me out because it's like, it's just the conversion guide and map pack. You already have to have the other adventure, so it's not a true conversion already, you know?
Yeah. Promotion based on the Dungeon Masters Guild community that sponsors OGL fan-based content in conjunction with Rock Sea. That's interesting, because I don't think you're allowed to Kickstarter stuff for DM's Guild, and I don't think you can take anything off DM's Guild and use it with something else.
No. I thought one of their basic stipulations was the reason why they take like half of your money is because you're allowed to play in Dungeon Dragons authorized worlds.
Yeah, you can use Elminster and Drizzt and etc.
Exactly, and you can use stuff that they're like, and this feels, well, the Red Hat of Doom is definitely 3rd edition, so I don't know, but I'm apprehensive about this one.
I think he's going to get in trouble if somebody finds out about this. I'm not telling nobody, but I think he's in.
Yeah, well, we're doing a podcast if somebody knows.
I'm going to be quiet.
And you're gonna pull Schultz. I know nothing.
I know nothing.
I believe the phrase is plausible deniability.
All right.
I was never here.
Let's go. This is a game I've never that this campaign for. Legacy of the Ancients, a campaign and player campaign setting and player's guide. So it's a 5th edition guide based on a collectible card game, the Legacy.
No, it's Commodore 64 game.
What was it?
Commodore 64 game. This is an old. I wonder if I had this.
Yeah, because I was wondering because CRPG. Oh. I my first thought was card role playing game, but no, it's.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Okay.
I don't
Before we get
this
into
one.
This, can I make a call out generally to all of your audience listeners? Okay, Commodore 64. You guys remember the Commodore 64, right?
Everybody? Yes.
Okay. There was a game on Commodore 64 where you played as Gargamel, and all you did was torture Smurfs. I had been trying.
My.
Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. You dropped in boiling pats of oil and all this great stuff. I can't find it. I found other people that remember it, that it exists. But like, if you are listening to this and you know where it is or can find it or anything like that, please contact me at mike.mylar.adventures@gmail.com. Okay,
well,
that's it. Thank you.
Send us a link as well because I'm actually curious.
Yeah.
Somewhat intrigued and somewhat horrified.
Well, there was a lot of hacked black market stuff, and I think my dad must have got it at a flea market or something, and then like somebody, some one of my horrible siblings lost the cartridge.
That's funny. Yeah.
All right, so this is based on a game for Commodore 64.
Yeah.
This Kickstarter called Legendary Legacy of the Ancients.
That sounds fun. Dude, this intrigues me more than a lot of games just by the sheer nostalgia value. Like, they know where to hit the zeitgeist, I'll say that much.
Oh, and they actually have a screenshot of the... what is that? Wait a minute. Goodbye. All right, I'm kind of curious. Did they... Because that looks like an old screenshot.
Yeah, you mean like the old pixel art basically redone? Or
Right, but
My
it says...
personal favorite is the graph paper map.
Yeah.
I think a stretch... That's their... Yeah, stretch goal stuff, I think.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you mean the one that says armor, flight, game speed, hold inventory?
Yeah, it must be a... Like a CD or something, you know, just like a fake CD cover.
I'm going to put this on the remind me list and see if it lasts 24 hours in my zeitgeist.
That's cool.
Okay.
Yeah,
he's probably, he'll make it, I think.
Yeah.
I think he'll make it.
Yeah, I mean, he's only asking 3,000. He has a little over 1,000 now. And
He's hit his 33% mark, so... And it's a small amount, so, you know, somebody coming in and swinging in $300 will make a huge difference.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, I want everything. All right, so what do we got? We got, this is an odd one, because it's like, There and Back Again, an anthology of traveling and gaming. An anthology of how travel impacts tabletop role-playing games.
Featuring stars of the RPG industry.
All right, let's see this.
Yeah, so it's an anthology of essays about how travel impacts and inspires gaming. We're talking about world travel, domestic travel, travel for work, road trips, and even just moving around a lot.
So this is more of an academic book.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seems kind of neat. I don't know. I'm getting a real accurate measurement of time off this thing to some degree.
Well, Jack Norris is in the writing pool. He's a good folk.
Right on.
Yeah.
He's normally doing stuff with Green Ronin over there.
I mean, it's...
No.
I mean, from an academic point of view, it's, you know, but it's one of those... I just don't...
Yeah. Yeah, I'm kind of in the same boat as well because
And...
It's setting off some vibes off me, but at the same time, the quality of the people actually involved are amazing. Like you said, like, you actually hit the people here.
But I don't think they're going to... It's based on the fact that there's 17 days to go.
Yeah.
They want $5,000. They got just under $800.
Yeah.
I'm going to call that unlikely.
Yeah.
I think they don't... They're not... They don't have enough of... They don't have enough information to do a buy-in.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think it's too early for this. I think it's a good time for them to, like, research and start taking notes and stuff. But this book, like, I mean, so...
What's its objective?
Yeah, like, what's the data pool? That's what I'm thinking. Like, what's the data pool? Like, so do you have, like, time codes for, like, when Gary Gygax thought of stuff and it involved travel or something to that effect for other games? Or like, the, you know, availability of print products in... You know, South America and like Brazil, for instance, and how that affected the RPG market there. Because I don't think you do, and nothing about this is yelling at me that you do.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody's listening that's actually involved in this project, come on and sell it us on the project, because I'm curious, but not enough to throw money at it.
Adventures campaign frameworks, some locations by real size people have visited. Yeah. It's nebulous. The pitch needs.
I mean, the way I read it, it's almost like, you know what? I took a trip to Ireland and it kind of inspired me. That's what this kind of is.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I guess it honestly, it'd be kind of like, I think what would be interesting for this, it's going to sound weird, but screw the book.
Yeah.
This would be an interesting podcast type discussion. Yeah. Where
or Patreon.
What was
it? A Patreon? A Patreon.
Something like that. But I'm just saying, that would be an interesting way to go about this, is, you know, have it as an ongoing project where, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks, once a month, whatever, you know, you would have an interview with somebody and, you know, maybe they went somewhere and they can talk about how that in some gaming.
I'm coming up
with new ideas all the time, folks.
Yeah.
I'm not doing that podcast. I'll admit that right now. But, you know, something like that, or even a set of.
You could theme it to be travel-loggy, you know?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Again, we like maps. Now tell us why we like maps.
Interesting, but.
Another Kickstarter, Dead Man's Guide to Dragongrin, 5th Edition Campaign Setting Guide, is a. It just says it's a dark fantasy realm of Dragongrin, which I think is kind of a weird little name. The description: evil reigns in the realm of Dragongrin, and the dismembered lord extends his reach, and the free lands kneel before his shadow. But his dark forces do not march unopposed. There are those who do the impossible in Dragongrin. Some of them call them fools, traitors, troublemakers, and others call them heroes. You are those heroes, and this is the book you need to forge your legend. So, sounds pretty fairly standard, you know, evil thing that the players have to oppose. They were only looking for about a little under $9,000. They've actually reached their goal and have over $30,000 U.S. right now. It looks good. I'm a little, some of it just seems a little unoriginal, but there you have it. It's not, it's out there. The next Kickstarter is Dead in the West, a tabletop RPG set in the mythic Old West. They're looking for roughly a little over $10,000 U.S. They got about $4,000 U.S. I think their major problem is that things like Deadlands, which isn't quite just straight Western, have kind of seized up that market. So while this may not be the, because it says it's a mythologized Old West setting and heavy emphasis on player individuality and engagement. I don't know. It's one of those things that I'm sure if someone gave me a copy, I'd look through and I might find something interesting. But I just don't see. It's facing stiff competition, so it'll be interesting to see if they can, if they'll make their goal. They still. They're only at 40% of their goal right now, and they only have a couple weeks left. I don't know. I'm not seeing it likely. So the last Kickstarter is on Wisconsin, for 5th Edition Dungeons & Dragons Adventure. For 4th, there's 4 to 6 characters, levels 1st to 2nd, as it says, 7 outdoor maps, 5 dungeons, several mythical creatures, and it's basically a mythical Wisconsin. Interestingly enough, they actually were only looking for a little over $1,700 US, and they got it. So it's going to be funded. I kind of dig the little old school pen and ink art here. It's not even that expensive. I think the PDF of the campaign, they're only asking $3. So, an adventure for that. Could be interesting for a couple of bucks. So, and that's all the Kickstarters. We also have the Bundle of Holding, which I think they're speaking of Deadlands. Two of the Bundle of Holdings that are available for the next couple of weeks is Deadlands Reloaded, which has a whole bunch of Deadlands stuff, and then Deadlands Servitors, which has some additional stuff. Supporting either of their things, 10% of the profits from, obviously, Bundle of Holding go to the charity, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. So if you have holes in your Deadlands stuff, and you want to pick up some PDFs for a good price that will also support a good charity, you might want to look into it. We also have Feng Shui 2, or Feng Shui, I never remember how to pronounce it. Those are actually available, pretty reasonable. And they're actually supporting the National Film Preservation Foundation, which personally I think is cool, because I'm a big fan buff. And lastly, there's not a lot of time left in these, folks. By the time this episode gets out, there's probably only going to be 1 or 2 days left, but we have Old and New. Which, by the way, our guest for this episode, Mike Myler, actually worked on some of this, so that's kind of cool. And they are fun. Their charity is Doctors Without Borders. So if anything in there interests any of your bundles of holding, maybe you have some of the material but you're missing some pieces, it might not be a bad idea to look at them and see what you can come up with.
All right, well, that's pretty much the end of this episode. And I want to thank Mike for coming on. Thanks for gracing us with your presence. It was really enjoyable to have you on, giving us some perspective on things that we definitely never had before.
Indeed.
Thank you for having me on. It was a fun time.
Yeah, you know, if you ever have anything interesting that you want to tell us, be sure to, you know, ping us. We'll be more than happy to have you on. We'll talk about it, do whatever. I don't care. I'm really flexible. That's one of the nice things when you run your own podcast. You know, like, hey, you have something interesting to say? You know, sure. Let's sit around and talk about it, because I've always envisioned, as I've always told the listeners, I've always envisioned this podcast as more of a conversation amongst gamers. Anyone who comes to this table, I don't care if you're a game designer of mythic proportion, we all come together and we're all equals at this table.
Cool. Like I said, it was a fun table to sit at.
Any other closing comments there, Chris?
Nothing really comes to mind other than, like I said before, thanks, Mike, for joining us, and we'll see what happens next time.
All right.
Yeah, I should add back the Imperial Matchmaker Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Da-da. Yeah.
I'll put another, even though it's in the link for last week's show notes, I'll include another link in it this week. So we'll have that there too. And I want to say, if anyone has anything they'd love to tell us, do us a favor. No, I was going to say keep it to yourself, but tell us anyway. You can reach us at info@rpgcircus.com. You can put a note in our on our comment section, either on Facebook or on the show note page on the website. And we still use the SpeakPipe application. No one has actually taken up us on that in a long time. It disheartens me. I love having someone else talk. I don't mind reading people's comments, but I sometimes flub those descriptions, something. So it's always great when the listeners actually speak their own minds, and we'll go ahead and play that on the air. And with that, I think we'll see everyone about in 2 weeks. And again, Mike, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you again for having me as a guest.
All right. And we will see everyone in roughly 2 weeks. RPG Circus is released on a Creative Commons Attribution US License 3.0. For more information, please visit creativecommons.org.